Good evening, all. We have a very lively crowd tonight. You know, a lot of architects in the audience. They're a rowdy bunch. So we're a little, not even 3 minutes late starting, but we had the design, the Fort Worth AIA Design Award prior to the lecture, which we do every year. So that's the reason we're running a little behind. And of course, there were a lot of people that wanted to grab the jurors' ears before the lecture began, so I'm kind of impressed that all this got pulled together, and sure enough, it did. And this is why I never went into theater, because this is the part I couldn't do this last minute, and it all comes together magically. And that happened tonight. You have landed in the Tuesday evening lecture series here at the Modern. I'm Terry Thornton, Curator of Education. This is one of my favorite parts of the job. I'm glad you're here tonight. It is a weekly series that happens this season. We've been going for a few weeks now, and we end on November 18th. So I hope you'll check online, see if there are others that appeal to you, and you'll come back and see us again. Next week, in conjunction with our exhibition, Urban Theater, New York Art in the 1980s, we have culture critic and curator Carlo McCormick here from New York to present what he's titled Crashing the After Party, Revelries and Radicalism in the Wake of Modernism. And what he's going to do, he's going to be looking at the broad field of creative practices from graffiti on the trains and art in the streets to the parties in the nightclubs and the protests in public spaces, all of which that involved many of the great artists and personalities of the era. So I think we're going to get the backstory. So I suggest that you come next week to hear what Carlo has to tell us. Tonight, the Modern is again honored to work with Fort Worth AIA to bring you one of the top thinkers and practitioners in architecture. Each year, for a few years now, we have joined efforts with the annual Fort Worth AIA Design Awards organizers and invited one of the outstanding jurors of the competition to give the Tuesday evening lecture. This year, we are fortunate to have James Cutler, fellow AIA founding partner of Cutler Anderson Architects, here to present ideas, philosophies, and work that speaks to how we design, think about, and experience spaces and buildings. With a Master's of Architecture degree from the Louis Kahn Studio Program and a Master of Architecture and a Bachelor of Arts degrees from the University of Pennsylvania, Jim is known for his environmental and emotional sensitivity to place, institution, program, climate, and cultural circumstance. Living on Bainbridge Island, Washington, since 1974, he is founding member of the Bainbridge Island Trust, a nonprofit organization which acquires interest in land having significant conservation values, such as scenic vistas, wetlands, wildlife corridors, and protection of animal habitats. So he lives what he preaches. Cutler Anderson Architects, a firm of 13 founded in 1977, has received 6 national honor awards from the American Institute of Architects and over 40 national and regional awards. Jim was recently awarded the Medal of Honor by the American Institute of Architects Seattle chapter. In addition to his practice, he has held teaching positions at Dartmouth, Harvard Graduate School of Design, Universities of California, Berkeley, Pennsylvania, Oklahoma, Washington, Oregon, and Middlebury College in Vermont. For this Tuesday evening presentation, he presents Searching for True, which I have to say is a lovely title, stating, quote, "We, Cutler Anderson Architects, have chosen as best we can to respect and reveal the nature of all of the elements that influence or are employed in the making of architecture. The institutions need to be clothed, the land must be respected, the structure asked to display its strength and order, and the materials want their nature revealed and respected. Each of these primary circumstances has multiple subsets that challenge us to learn more at every turn. We find ourselves constantly searching, sometimes discovering, sometimes missing, but always challenged." So with that primer, please join me in welcoming Jim Cutler.
Okay. First, could you turn the lights down a little? You guys don't want to look at me. You want to look at that. And I've got big ears and I'm old. So if you can get the lights down, it'll make the photos look better. So first, I'm honored to be here. And I'm not just saying that because, first, I'm in a Tadeo Ando building. Across the street is a building that was being built when I was studying with Lou Kahn, who did the Kimball. And then beyond that is the Renzo Piano Building. So you have pretty much a display. It's sort of the catalog of some of the greatest architects of the last century and this century here. And I'm honored to be speaking in this place. So that's first. I rewrote a lecture for tonight after doing the jury today, and I'm going to be more proselytizing a little bit than I normally do. So what I hope to do is illustrate through our work a set of beliefs. And the set of beliefs actually were instigated by Lou Kahn and my studies with him. And I look back upon my own career and I see that the wellspring of all the things I really believe strongly in was stuff I learned from Lou's Socratic method of teaching us. And at this point, I've diverged from his, because he was a different person than me, and I've applied those beliefs to, I think, a broader view of our place in this planet. So, that said, I need to at least espouse a philosophy. And so here I'm going to try it. I'm going to use sort of a syllogism. So, everything in this world, everything, has a set of characteristics that make it unique. Okay? I call it something's nature. And so as an example, I'll choose this lectern. Okay? So the lectern here is, it holds this iPad, it's got all the microphones, it's got my bottle of water, it's pretty stable, I can hide behind it, somebody throws something. It's got a set of characteristics that define it as being a lectern. Now, if I really wanted to define the lectern, I could fill this room up with writing, because we could get into the molecular nature of the wood, the guys who fabricated it, the history of lecterns, why people speak it on forever about it. But if we did that, we never communicate. So we use shorthand. We call things by names. We've called this the lectern. But we could say all those characteristics that I just described mean lectern, all right? So I could design a lectern here that things slid off of and it wobbled and, it just didn't do any of the things a lectern did, but it was beautiful. And we could call it art, but it wouldn't be a lectern because it wouldn't fulfill the definition of lectern. Does that all make sense to you guys? I'm just winging it here. Does it make sense to you? Okay. So I can say all those characteristics are the lectern, or I can say all those characteristics that are here is Jim, right? And so what we do in our office, and it's not necessary to do this, we elect to respect all of the characteristics of all of the circumstances that in which we create architecture. Okay? That's something we elect to do. And it isn't necessary for architects to do that. But towards the end of this lecture, I'm going to make the case, and not many architects do that. But towards the end of this lecture, I'm going to make the case that it is necessary and important in our age. So that said, what we do is whether it's, I'm going to now start touching this thing. Good, it works, right? Whether it's a place, and I'll just name these. I'm going to illustrate with some of our own work. This is a little guest house. A house on the sea, on a rocky shore. But these are all places in the forest, in the desert. Or on the fog-bound coast of Northern California. Or in a city. These are all circumstances in which we want to respond to those unique circumstances. Or it's a material, wood, or steel and stone and concrete, or even plaster and wood and steel. Each of these materials has a nature to which we want to respond. Aluminum, modern material, or an institution, because all of our buildings are really merely garments that institutions wear. In this case, a church. Or even an event, this being in a memorial, the Salem witch trials that we did. Okay, so that was kind of high-sounding words, right? And it's one thing to say it. It's a whole other thing to do it. And it's really hard. I mean, it's really hard to take in and sort of apprentice yourself to every circumstance that you are in which you're going to create shelter, in which you're going to make architecture. And the way I tell my staff is that I hear voices, right? You know, and that they believe me. And the deal is that you know, if everything has a nature and we elect to respond to that nature, then that thing, whatever it is, then has a will, because we've given it a will to respond to its nature. And in our world, if it has a will, it's got a spirit. And our job is to reveal and reflect that spirit. Okay? So, and what I tell everybody in the office is when we start a project, it's like walking into a room full of second graders. Have you ever done this? You've ever taught second grade? Have you been in a second grade class? And you ask an easy question like, what's 1 + 1? And everybody raises their hand, and they're all yelling, call on me, and they're all raising their hand because they all want to show how good they are, how smart they are. They know the answer, right? And it's this cacophony of just kids screaming at you. And that's the way I see projects starting. It's just all these inputs that you need to apprentice to, that you need to learn about, and they're all screaming at once. And the job is to take that cacophony of sound and turn it into a harmony. Is to actually, when you're at your very best in my world, you're not really designing, you're just listening to all the components and getting them all to work together, to sing in harmony. So that's our real job in our office. And it isn't easy, and I'm accused of being the flow bearer of architecture sometimes, of going back and detailing and redetailing and working things over until they're just right, until all the voices are satisfied. So that's a bunch of words, and these were a bunch of projects. And what I thought I would do was I would take three or four, I don't know how many I put in here, maybe four projects, five projects, and I would examine them using the criteria that I just gave you for what we believe. Seems like a fair test, okay? So this happens to be the North Shore of Hawaii. And I put this slide in because those plants grow like that because it blows so goddamn hard all the time that's the way they grow. Anything that sticks its nose out a quarter inch past the edge of that cliff gets blown off. And so the plant got completely shaped by the wind. And we were hired to do a resonance on the North Shore of Hawaii, which it blows on average about 30 knots, 300 to 320 days a year. And along with the wind comes spitting rain about every half hour. You can see a storm coming in and blowing at you. It's a rainforest. And this is the trade winds coming in on the North Shore. So that's the environment in which we were asked to place a building. A residence, in this case. The residence, the institution for a residence, by the way, it's family. You know, what are you doing? You're actually making a garment to shelter a family. So when I use the term garment, in Hawaii, it's a pretty light garment. If I'm doing it in Alaska, it's a pretty dense garment. They're different. So here are the inputs. I'm going to see if this works. Oh, it does. Great. Okay, so here comes the wind and rain spitting at you at 30 knots. And here's the sun over here, and out there there's a spectacular view of the ocean. And if you examine the nature of view, you're going to find it's very primary to almost every culture in the world, because it's actually something, the reason we respond to it is because, how do I put it, it's defensibility. You know, if you were out on the veldt a million years ago, you wanted to see who was coming to eat you. And so when you were in a defensible position, you liked it. So we all respond to view because it's something very primary in us, and because it's cross-cultural. So in any case, so the view is important. And then there's the institution of family. So just to go very simply through that, you know, you come in an entrance and you get a choice. You have this little dog leg that takes you back to private areas, and you have an invitation into public areas. That's the most simple aspect of the anatomy of family. And we could get much more detailed with it. And I very often tell people that I'm a tailor, because we examine the anatomy of a very specific family and we tailor their shelter, their garment to them. So in this case, we got all this wind coming in and the sun's over here. And honestly, if you stand out in this stuff, you can't even talk to each other. It's so, the wind's blowing in your ears. And so we thought, how are we going to do a building? Well, first we did a courtyard. We did the courtyard to wind shelter, a swimming pool, so you could lie in the sun and sit by the side of the pool. Pretty reasonable. But then the next question is, how else does that circumstance, that specific circumstance, affect the making of the building? So this gives you a sense of where it is. And you can see the wind's blowing, surprisingly, all the time. And so what we did is we designed a building that fit in plan the institution of family, but we canted the roof so it was tipped to the wind, so that it actually kind of has like a baseball cap that tipped down into the wind, and the building began to shape itself specifically to the wind. You can see that's a single line. There it is again as a single line. We compound pitched the roof so it tipped in two directions towards the wind, but the face of the building looked right to the view. And because it's Hawaii and we don't need a very heavy garment, it's pretty glassy and open. But we can't, every time you open the windows, of course, everything blows around. But you can open up the back windows. So this is that pool. This is the room, and there's the view. And we, you know, when you're in Hawaii, you don't want to spend a lot of time inside. You want to spend it outside. So when you're in your wind sheltered area here with the pool, we just had the whole building open up and be glassy, so you could see right through out to the view. So it allowed us to connect to the view, give us good wind shelter, and in many ways reveal the structure. But there's more stuff going on in Hawaii than that. That not only is the wind blowing, but they get earthquakes, okay? Because the Big Island's an active island, actively growing, I should say. And, you know, the engineers came back and said, oh, you know, this light roof, the wind's going to blow it right off, and the earthquake's going to knock it down. And so we cross-braced it to accommodate the shear forces from the earthquake. But then we started thinking about this, the wind blowing the roof off, and we thought, well, you know, that's a true thing. We're not going to hide that. So these steel members go up, and they slide between these double 2x12 and 2x8, and then they pin down into this lava rock foundation. And it is lava, you know, because it's from the place. And so they hold the roof down visibly, and they actually are doing their job. So they pin into a massive source, and then they, because steel's so strong in tension, it rises up, grabs into that roof and holds it down. So the wind became the determinant of the detailing and the fabrication of the building. So in this circumstance, besides responding to the institution of family, the climate and the place generated the shape and the making of the building and the materials of the place. So, and there it is. Wind's still blowing. So, okay. Next, this is a library. And this is a, I described this to some of the members, not the jury, but some of the staff today that were helping. And a little community of that's primarily a bedroom community. That is, it's about 10,000 tract houses and a shopping, defunct shopping center. They incorporated and wanted an architect to come and give them a sense of who they were. And they hired us because we were well-known architects. And it was a little forest, an acre and three quarters. And it was a second or third growth forest. In the Northwest, forests grow really quick. So you cut down the forest 20 years later, 30 years later, you got another forest. This is about a third growth forest. And it was had a lot of trees. And we thought, you know, this could be quite beautiful. And what's the library about? The library's about learning and depository of knowledge. And there are probably some books in here that say we need to develop a little bit more benign relationship with the living world. Let's fit this thing carefully. And so we did a couple things. Instead of doing a parking lot, we did a parking estuary. And we did it by walking around for all of 5 hours with an arborist with a couple of iron spikes. It felt around for roots, and we carefully laid out a parking lot in the trees, cut down three trees for 70 cars. That's with about 170 trees on the property. Didn't take any time at all. The other was that we had children in this building, and buildings take a lot of water off the earth. I mean, I was telling someone today that architecture is a very destructive business. It's actually a very hypocritical business in that, you know, like civil engineers, they're trained to kill the planet and they enjoy it. And so you can't fault them for it because at least they're consistent. But architects walk around, you know, pretending that they're Mr. Sensitivity and thoughtful and artistic while they kill just as much of the planet. And they don't take credit for it. And so we got into the role of trying not to kill things. And in this circumstance, buildings take a lot of water off the ground, and it rains a lot where I'm from. And so we said we would do a hip-shaped roof here so that all of the roofs pitch to the court, and that we would take all the water out of one downspout. And we calculated out, and it came out in a good rainstorm, about 300 gallons a minute. And it would come out in this great bowl here, and it would spill out, and the bowl was serrated so that it would carry the spores of debris that fell on the roof, and we'd have this great bowl of moss that would grow there, and the children would see the relationship between water and life. And so this was it just after construction. Actually, what we did is to jumpstart, this is classic, to jumpstart the moss, right after this was built, we covered the whole thing in visqueen and plastic. And by the time the library opened, it was this beautiful bowl of moss. And I thought, boy, that's great. And then I came back about a week later, and the maintenance guys had sandblasted it all off. And they said, your beautiful sculpture was being ruined by the moss. But it came back. It came back. But I thought that was pretty humorous. It's just we had this other discussion today about how the worst thing about modern architecture is it's at its best the day it's done, and it gets nothing but worse after that. And that we ought to be designing architecture that it accepts moss and mold and mildew, and that it becomes just an armature for life, for growth. And this was our first attempt at that. In any event, the building got built, very low budget. We had the contractor come in and fit things exactly. We had one little construction road, talked to all the workmen about how important it was to save this old growth, this actually third growth forest. They looked at me sideways, but they came out, they scaffolded, as soon as the foundation was poured, they scaffolded the whole perimeter of the building. They never set foot outside the perimeter after we started. And so by the time we were done, we had this building that was well fit right in the forest. And there was a lot of fighting about this because the community thought that I was going to come and do some great monument for them that was going to put them on the map. And there was some chance that it wasn't going to be built because the community thought it was too ordinary. And it went on to win the National Honor Award. But what I told them was there are going to be a lot of books in this library that tell this kid how we should coexist with this planet, and that the building in which they sit should be exemplary of that set of beliefs. So the bottom line of it was they built it, and you can see it's fitted so well that you're in the forest, and you're emotionally connected to it. And I hope, maybe I believe, but I mostly hope that when this child grows up, that they expect that this is the way that we're going to interact with living systems and architecture. Okay, let's go on to another one. To go from that to something kind of change scales, and I'll go through this quickly. This is a high-rise building. It's a federal office building in downtown Portland, Oregon. And when you look at office buildings, and you guys know this, particularly in your climate, they're driven by cooling, not by heating. And this is Portland, Oregon, and we felt that we should do a building that was exemplary, both from a technical energy standpoint, but also emotionally exemplary in terms of stating the government's commitment to sustainability in the future. And it was an existing building, actually, and which helped us a lot. It was an existing 1972 building, of which the government had built 19 identical ones in most every major city in the U.S. I mean, there are 19 of this building, all clones. And they were going to let us experiment with reskinning it. And so that's what we did. We went to them, and actually it's a long story, but they were just going to do a security mechanical upgrade. And a big firm in Portland asked if I wanted to be lead design on it. And we said, sure, and maybe, and let's look at it. And then when we looked at it, we realized it was a concrete precast. I'm sure you've seen this building in another city. Big concrete precast skin, like a Breuer-esque windows deep set. We realized that there was 2 feet of structure, of floor space being removed by the skin. So if we took the skin off and put a new skin on that was right at the edge of the structure, we'd pick up, I think, 24,000 square feet of extra rentable space. And the building needed a seismic upgrade, and the concrete was so damn heavy that if we took it off, it wouldn't need the seismic upgrade because we would have unloaded all the lateral forces on the building. So we went to them and said, you know, you can make money if you just take all the skin off and let us do a good building. And they bought it. And so the deal here is that Portland's twisted off-grid. And we realized that the sun is doing a different thing at different times of day. So what we ended up doing was every side of the building has a different treatment. We treated it as a pure glass box and then hung armatures off of it. And the big heat gainer, as you all know, is the western side. So that's the western side of the building. And I don't quite know how to describe it, but there's these great screens that are also designed to carry vegetation in the long run that go up 283 feet, and they shelter that side of the building. They'll grow vegetation. And you can see they're not all the same because one's an entrance and one's an exit, so they just tip out for entry and exit. And then the next side is a little different than that because the south side, the sun's higher in the sky. We don't need to do these horizontal, these vertical shades. We only needed to do horizontal shades, and we used them as light reflectors. We also shaped the vertical shades here so they'd bounce light around them and actually throw light more back into the space. And you can see it's capped by a roof, which is a 33,000 square foot photovoltaic array. And the north side, which is different, that's a circumstance, didn't need any shading, so we just left it alone. This is a sense of scale on the street, and the plants are just starting to grow on it now. It's only a year old. It has a strange scale, to say the least. And as I said, it was an existing building, and we thought, well, you know, it was existing. Those guys might have built a bad building, but they still put a lot of effort into it. we ought to give them their due. Let's not try to make it a modern, new, all perfect building. Let's just, where we need to fix it, we'll cut the concrete out. We'll just remove it, and we'll leave the saw cuts, and just let it be the structure of the building. Honor those people who built the superstructure by showing the good things and even the defects. There's some amazing concrete blowouts in this building that we were so delighted to find because they show the humanity of the people who first built it. Rebar, whole deal. And it's the aesthetic of the building, and we were just told it won the best high-rise in the Western Hemisphere. Not too much more to say other than that. And yes, you can see through the screens, and you barely notice them after a while. And it is an armature for life. This is going on a different side of circumstance. We competed, how do I put this, in about 1991, an artist for whom I'd done a residence came in her office and wanted to know if I was interested in working on a competition with her for a memorial for the 300th anniversary of the Salem witch trials. And I looked at it for just a minute, and I, of course, blurted out the crucible. We all know the crucible here, right? Okay. But the reason I blurted it out, and this is, again, this is an event, but I think we tried to display the nature of this event. But the reason I blurted it out was that, how do I put it? In 1955, I called my father a communist in public. Okay? Not a good thing to do. And he was at some meeting with a bunch of guys in public square near my hometown in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. And I was with him. It was on a Sunday. And he said, oh, I got to go to a meeting. And I said, yeah, my dad's got to go to one of his communist meetings with about 40 people standing around. And I remember him, he's the gentlest, most wonderful person I've ever known in my life, but his fingers digging in my arm and me being dragged back in an alley and looking up at him. And this combination of absolute fear and absolute anger of this happening. And I explained that my uncle had told me that he was a communist. And of course, that created a fairly major family problem. And the result was that the uncle was required to take me to New York to see the Crucible. Because the Crucible was the first veiled indictment of McCarthyism. You know, everybody was afraid back then. Everybody was afraid of that witch hunt, communist witch hunt. And nobody fought back. And the first veiled indictment was Arthur Miller's play, The Crucible. And I was taken to see it. And in the middle of the play, if any of you guys remember it, there's this point at which the children are being strangled by spectral evidence. That is, like there's an accused in the box, and the children start clutching their throats and saying, she's strangling me, and, you know, writhing. And I was told right at that minute, this horrifying minute, this is what happens to little children who tell lies about their parents. So it really stuck with me, okay? So I literally, Maggie came in with this thing. We literally, it's Maggie Smith, she's a ceramic artist, and we just sat down in the conference room for about 5 hours and came up with four words that exemplified the injustice that happened in 1692. And what it was is the first word we use was silence, because in 1692, if you were accused of being a witch, nobody would stand up for you, because you were afraid of being accused yourself if you tried to defend them, which is the exact same thing that happened in 1952 in this country. So the first is silence. This stuff happens because of silence. The second was deafness. Deafness, in this case, if you were accused, that was it. You were in league with the devil. No one was going to listen. You were condemned. And you had two choices. You could either admit you were in league with the devil, which in their world, not ours, but theirs, condemned their immortal souls forever, or you died. there was no middle ground. You either died and or one or the other. And so there were 20 people in Salem who were hanged for not wanting to damn their immortal souls forever. So the judges never heard a word. And the same thing happened in 1952. You're accused of communism. It was almost impossible to get out of it. The third word we used was persecution, because these people were persecuted for false reasons. Same thing in 1952. And the final word that we used was memory, that we'd need to remember all of this. Because if we don't remember it, it happens again. So I literally went home that night because I was so pumped, basically. And we were lucky in that, let's see, here it is. The piece of land we were given was right in the middle of the Charter Street Cemetery in downtown Salem, in which are buried the citizens of 1692. And we were even luckier in that there was a grade. You can see this grade coming down right here. So the first thing we did was we dug out the middle. This was in the competition phase. We dug out the middle of our plot of land, and we surrounded it by a stone fence. And the stone fence was to separate the accused from the community. But at the back of the stone fence, we knocked it out and put a sharp iron bar so that when you walk to the back of this thing, you're looking through bars into the cemetery, and they're all the gravestones are uphill from you, so they look like the silent watchers of 1692, all the people who were silent. So that was for silence. For deafness, Maggie went into the court records from 1692, they're still available, and she actually found the protests of innocence of the accused, their words right from the records, and we inscribed them on this threshold as you walk into the memorial, but in mid-sentence, they disappear. They're unheard. It's as if they're uncovered. So there's one here that says, "I am no wit," and the rest of the word's gone. So that was for silence, or for deafness. And then for persecution, we planted a bosque of black locust trees from which they were hanged. And if you know, do you guys have black locust here? They're the deeply fissured bark, and they grow in very strange ways. They're almost haunted-looking trees, and they're very, very hard wood, and that's why you can hang someone from it, the branch doesn't break. And then finally, for memory, we cantilevered from the wall 20 stone benches for the 20 people who were murdered, because when they were murdered, they were also excommunicated, and their bodies were thrown out into the forest. Families might have picked them up, but they were believed to be taken by animals, and none of them had ever had a marker for the last 300 years. So we gave each one of them a marker for who they were, the date of execution, and how they were executed, because there were several methodologies. So we sent that in, and there were like 870 entries, and we won. So, so this is the memorial. This is for silence. This is actually Judge Hathorne's grave, Nathaniel Hawthorne's grandfather, who was one of the judges who condemned them. Silence. See the thresholds for deafness. I can deny it to my dying death. I am no wit. For deafness. Black locust. For persecution, memory, memory. So, let's go on to something a little less weighty. This is the last project, if I'm boring you. It's church. Now, I'm not even Christian, but we got hired to do this church. And I posited to the congregation that the church is a place of contemplation, it's a place of uplifting, and that to some extent it ought to be contemplative, and that the first thing I wanted to do was get rid of the parking lot. And of course, I got to drive there because it's a suburban church. It's actually on the island I live on. And so we thought, we posited to them, we said, hey, think of it, it's November. It rains all of November, and it never gets above about 42 degrees, and it's just cold and rainy. And it's Sunday, you're late, you got two screaming kids in the back of the car. Is that the way, do you want to drive into a parking lot to go to church? What if we design this road so that you come along, and we twist it, and we come up over a hill, and you get to a certain point, and you have a vista of grace. Great, that's the name of the church, but you have this vista of grace. And then instead of going to a parking lot, you go into a great circle. And you park your car, and then you get out of the car, and on a different center point radius, you get on a path that takes you to grace. And the closer you get to grace, the farther you move away from the cars. And that we put this axis, the property had been clear-cut at the time, and there was one standing big leaf maple tree, very large tree right here, that we put that on axis for life. And then we'll come back and let this forest restore itself, which it has now. It's very cool. It's completely restored. So that when you arrive, there would be this vista. And it's dark, by the way, in November almost all the time. We only get about 5 hours of daylight. It's really dark. And with 20,000 feet of, you know, of what I guess, what would you call it, cloud cover, it's really dim. So in any case, that's that axis to the tree. And then there's the nature of this institution. And, you know, there's Christ, which is Alpha and Omega. And when we were excavating, we found a couple of glacial erratics. You don't have them here too far south, but that's a rock that the glacier has carried maybe 1,000 miles and then melted away and dropped it on your property. And we found this glacial erratic, and we marked it up and chalked it and worked with a sculptor, and we turned it into a baptismal font so that the water there, you can see this zinc strip that flows right here, and out of that end of that zinc strip flows water that goes into this font, and the strip continues the whole length of the building, and it becomes the cross at the opposite end. So it's the Alpha and the Omega of the nature of this institution. And then we were working on the structure like anybody does, and you can see this structure. It's concrete, and I'll get into that in a moment. There's this massive concrete, these 14-foot deep, 70-foot long trusses that the lower cord carries the low bay, and the nave is carried by the upper cord. And you know, this ceiling, the ridge here is about 35 feet tall. And just like your building right out here in your lobby, I notice all the mullions are backed up by I-beams because of wind loading. And my engineers, they wanted to put I-beams, you know, here, and I said, we're not doing that. And then I realized I had these two big concrete piers on either side, and the concrete's there to resist lateral forces, and I'll get into that in a minute. But then I thought, great, what we'll do is we'll resist the lateral forces horizontally by taking them to between these two concrete piers and then drag the loads out into the ground. And then it hit me that it could be the cross. So that this cross is actually a structural element of the building. It actually reinforces the physics of the building. So I'm really very, very close to the end. We've got about 3 minutes here. So this building, even though it's probably not our most famous building, to me, is the most, what's the word, emblematic of what I said in the beginning. In the sense that we've done really nothing here. There are forces. There are earthquake forces, which are pretty severe in our area. And those forces need to be taken out with these battered, massive piers that take those loads and drag them into the ground. The piers also carry the giant trusses that carry the roof. And the roof's pitched because that's what sheds the rain. And so there's no element on this whole design that we did willfully. Everything is driven by the circumstances of the wind, the rain, the earth movement, and the institution. And this particular institution with its baptismal font, with its cross, with its large room for congregating. So in a way, we didn't design anything. All we did was we apprenticed ourselves to every single circumstance and allowed each circumstance to express itself and be revealed. And then all we did was orchestrate how they all fit together. So that's the result of that little endeavor. And as I mentioned at the beginning, that I was going to make a case here, so I'm now going to spend a couple minutes making a case. So the last slide I have here is a silly one. Okay, so there's a book I read once. I read a lot. And this book, it's got this incredibly pretentious title. It's called Life. And it's written by the chief paleontologist of the British Museum, a guy named Richard Forty. Any of you ever heard of Richard? Oh, you got to read it. It's a great book. Anyhow, Richard's this great, very iconic British writer, and he's the chief paleontologist. And what he does is he takes you from this molten rock out in the universe to us in about 380 pages. I mean, it's compelling reading, how he goes, and he does it all with little stories. And it's a great book. And the amazing thing is you turn to the last page, and it's a photograph. And it's a photograph of slot machines in mirrors. And that is, you know when you have two parallel mirrors, the images go on forever? And it's a photograph of slot machines just going on forever. And his point is that we were not inevitable. I mean, what we are, you know, us right here, we were not inevitable. We are the result of a million times a million times a million random events and chances that happen in this universe. You know, why do we have five fingers? Because something with six fingers, a tree fell on it, or a comet killed it. We're the result of a lot of random things over eons that have created us. So when you look at the statistics, yeah, there's probably other life in the universe, but something like us, is at least in this galaxy, is probably statistically close to impossible. That's something that's just like us, which means there may not be anything else out in this universe or in this galaxy that has the ability to cognate, that is, to know their life, to know the world around them. There may not be anything in this universe that loves. It could be a gift that only we have. The idea that we have this gift of cognition is just, it's a gift beyond imagining. And we take it for granted. And so in this world that is just such an incredibly beautiful place that I personally deeply love, I can think of no higher calling for an architect than to develop their design so it reveals, reflects, and protects this living world. And the only way we're going to protect this planet is for people to love it. And to love it, we need to do buildings that both respect it and actually heighten our sense of understanding it and loving it. And I just simply can't say more than that. That's the end of my lecture. I feel strongly about this, and it is a journey. And my hope is that, as proselytizing to you now, that we think more about architecture as really a continuum of a living world. And we think of architecture not as an object, but as a way to view the living world and to be an armature in which the living world can grow, as opposed to objects that are basically our vanity. So that's it. That's my lecture. Okay. So I always have this situation where I ask if there are questions, and nobody asks any questions, and then afterwards people come up and keep me here for another hour or two. And it would be great if you all had questions. I can answer them, but I'm told that the restaurant closes at 9, right? And that I'm not to linger too long. So if any of you have questions, I'm happy to answer them, and it's better if you ask them because then everybody gets to hear the answer. no questions. Yes?
What was the budget on that Hawaii house?
I'm too old to remember. I think it was $300,000 or $400,000, something like that. But it was about 8 years ago. Yep.
Did your client, the church, know that in fact you weren't a Christian?
Yes. Yes. Yeah, I had a very strange upbringing. I'm Jewish. But I went from fifth grade through the end of high school to a Methodist seminary. I was first in my class in New Testament Bible studies and was president of the senior class and could have gone on to become a minister. Okay? But so I have more, and my parents were afraid I'd lose my sense of being Jewish. So after sports and everything late at night, I had to go study with a rabbi. So I've got more religion stuffed in my head than anybody you can imagine. So, yes?
Where was that church located?
That's on Bainbridge Island. That's one of the few projects I've done on my island. So, yep.
I was just wondering if you followed a lot of Frank Lloyd Wright's architecture, because he liked believing in putting his structures as an extension of the natural world.
Well, I think that it's something bigger than that. It's not necessarily someone's philosophy. I think it's an obligation. I think it's a fundamental obligation, and Wright did it, out of love. And I certainly espouse this because I grew up in the forest, eastern forest, not western forest, but I grew up in the forest hunting mushrooms with my uncles every Saturday and Sunday of my life. And it's something I learned to love when I was young. And I believe he learned to love something, and he wanted other people to see how beautiful that was, and he choreographed his architecture and his paths into the architecture so that the most beautiful elements could be visible and apparent to everybody. You know, the thing is, and I sometimes liken this to like a photographer. You know, you have some really great photographer, some world-class photographer. He walks down, you know, he walks down a street you've walked down every day of your life, and you just, you know, you got your TV or your work or your girlfriend, or you got something on your mind, and you just walk down that street. Same guy walks down the street with his camera, takes a picture of a crack in the sidewalk that makes you want to cry. It's so beautiful. Okay? So he has revealed something that was always there in front of us. And that's my hope, that architects do that, that they reveal what's there, tangible reality. This whole thing with virtual reality scares the hell out of me, because it takes us one step farther away from seeing the real world and making it acceptable. So, you know, I am always trying to force people to look at the tangible world, not the virtual world. And so in comparison to Wright, no, I'm not necessarily studying him or trying to copy him or even thinking about his philosophy. I'm just doing what I love. Yep.
Do you ever have a problem with time on your projects, because the idea of hearing voices and listening, you just can't hurry that up, I imagine?
Well, I've got to run a business, and I'm sometimes on time, not always. I'd say about a quarter of the time I'm on time. and if I'm late, usually the client is colluding with me to be late, because I'll see something late in the process and I'll go, look, I won't even charge you a fee. I got to change this. It's not right. And they'll go along with me. I usually have to butter them up with money. But you only go around once. And you want to do things that are as good as they possibly can be. And sometimes you see it just like that, and sometimes you don't. And if you see it late, then yeah, I'm going to be late, because I'm not going to do it wrong. I tell you a great story, but not now. I mean, about the term is better dead than late. I ascribe to the opposite philosophy. So, second?
Well, that was actually my second, so here's a third. Are you able to, given that your clients know who you are by now, are you able to actually maybe slow them down because they know that's what they're getting when they
Not always. I mean, there are different kinds of projects we do, like working for the federal government. They're not the most romantic people in the world. We were dead on time with those guys. That building was on time and under budget. And we had a little spare money at the end to spend. That was 500,000 square feet, and it was $130 million. And it was tough. And, you know, there were sacrifices. There were things we gave up. Like, I wanted it from that big PV, the big PV roof. I wanted to run one downspout down. It's 33,000 square feet, and in Portland that would mean 600 gallons a minute in a rainstorm. And I wanted to run it on a runnel right along the side of the sidewalk so people could see it and then let mold and moss grow in it. It would have been great, but just couldn't make the budget. So it's too expensive, and everybody was afraid of it. Yeah.
With the world moving rapidly towards more and more dense urbanization, how do you deal with the idea of nature within these increasingly megacities that we have?
That's why I was showing you the federal building. I mean, I have to tell you, it was in the New York Times a few years ago before it reached this form. It was originally designed to have that western wall be a living wall, but deciduous planting, so that in the summer it would be completely shaded and would get no heat gain, and in the winter it would drop its leaves and get a little heat gain. And the idea was to take what is endemic in nature and make basically a cyborg building, a building that helped heat and cool itself through living substance. And what happened was there was a big article in the New York Times before it was built, and John McCain came out and put it on his, it was second on the list of 10 of the 10 worst boondoggles of the American Recovery Act. And then GSA, which are great guys, really great guys, they had a run for cover. They're a political football. And so I had to basically, 6 months before they were already in demolition, I had to redesign the whole skin of the building and get it designed, detailed with Benson Engineering for the curtain wall, for blast-proof, blast-resistant, and have it ready for on time for construction. That was a push. But so going back to time, yeah, sometimes I got to be on time. And if there isn't, if someone doesn't give me a deadline, I never get done. I just keep changing it. So because you're always learning. But right now we have 6 projects under construction in 5 states. So, 13 people. But we, like the high-rise, we get larger firms very often will ask to join. They'll call us up and say, we got this building. We think we'd like you to be the design lead. And, and basically the deal is that the way I put it is they get all the money and I get all the glory, and which is fine with me. I'm old and I'd rather have the glory than the money at this point. So can I be excused now and go to dinner? Thanks.